You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after 4, our guest will share some memories about lava lamps on their 50th anniversary.
First, what does it take to be a good leader? Is it an inborn talent, a skill we can acquire, or is it something deeper?
Al Genie has been thinking about those questions. He's professor of business ethics and chair of the management department at Loyola University Chicago. He's co-author of 10 Virtues of Outstanding Leaders, Leadership, and Character. Al, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
But when I think of leadership, if I think of it at all, I think of it as like a set of skills or maybe a personality style. You say it's a matter of character and virtue. Why?
Well, it's actually fundamentally about that, and I want to come back to that. When you ask anybody what's a leader or who are your favorite leaders, they'll come up with kind of an obvious group of people or even a divergent group of people, but they'll all be somewhat different in demeanor and talent and temperament. And I think there's no one specific definition of leadership. I don't think there's one specific leader or one specific leader model that, you know, takes care of every possibility. But rather, I think, and there won't no series of attributes that are absolutely there, but rather I think that at the bottom, at the foundation of leadership, there's something you have to call character and something we want to call stewardship. That is, why are you a leader? What do you believe in and why are you a leader? And secondly, why are you leading the way you are leading? That is, what is your real job? And I think how people answer that is the foundation for leadership. And then everything else depends not on a definition, but rather a variable formula.
So by the time we're grown-ups and we're getting into leadership positions, is it possible to change our character and develop the virtues we're going to talk about, or are we locked in? It's too late.
Well, you know, character from the Greek is, you know, characteros, but it's about the etchings that are marked on us and like in stone. But now, modern psychology and I think modern philosophy suggest that there's also the learned character, the acquired character. But character, I mean what you value, what you believe in, what you're willing to act on, what empowers you, what brings you into the world. Eleanor Roosevelt said it best, you want to know a person's character, check their checkbook. How do they spend their money? Mm. What do they do? And I think character, like so much that we do in life, we expand, we develop. But after a certain point, I think there becomes this fixed nexus, this fixed, you know, center post that we call character. And that's how we judge people. That's how we decide if someone is a friend. That's how we decide if this person is a lover. That's how we decide if we really care about our family. What do they believe in and how do they act it out?
When people are taught to be managers or leaders, whether at an MBA school or in a leadership seminar, is what you're talking about what they're getting, or is it a set of tactics?
Well, you know, if you go around the country and look at the leadership courses in MBA programs, you'll find every difference possible. And you get a lot of OD stuff, organizational development. What do you do when 3 employees come in and one is claiming unfair practice, so on and so forth? And I call that kind of management manipulation. How do you handle that best in that circumstance? If you take my advanced course in leadership, it starts with the first book written on leadership, which is Plato's Republic, you know, and the pursuit of justice and how do you organize a state. So I think there are theoretical models by handling it, and there are also mechanical, more behavior modification models. But both are necessary. Nobody wants, I'm reading Wilson's book right now. Wilson was a student of leadership. I'm reading Wilson's biography, excuse me. But Wilson also believed that leadership can't simply be a series of, ideological statements. It has to be lived out amongst others for it to be real.
The core of your book is looking at virtues and how to develop them and role models to look to. Why do you think it was important to look for historical role models historical and present day, I should say?
Yeah. Aristotle said we really don't learn virtue by reading a treatise on ethics. We learn virtue by the witness of others. We learn virtue by how other people behave. Garrison Keillor on these airwaves said years ago that if you want your children not to smoke, not to drink, and not to eat meat, you have 2 alternatives. You don't smoke, eat meat and you don't drink, or you do smoke, you do eat meat. You know, one way or another, they'll react to it. And I think that's true. So I think we've always held up these wonderful leaders. And so this book, in some sense, is about characters with character. But having said that, perhaps the best contribution that this book makes of, you know, the 20,000 plus books out there on leadership is we talk about the importance of studying bad leaders as well. Because not to study bad leaders is to be vulnerable to their tactics and their strategy. Not to study bad leaders is like going to medical school that only teaches health but never touches on disease.
I want to get into the good leaders in a minute and the virtues. Who's a bad leader? Who's a cautionary example? Give us one or two.
Well, in the modern world right now, I mean, the players at Enron are a classic example. And I thought Enron would be the benchmark forever. Jeff Skillings and the organizer of the place as well. I'm blanking on his name right now. Please forgive me. That whole cadre of people who, if you see the film, Smartest Guys in the Room, you see these men talking about the manipulation of others for self-aggrandizement and self-wealth. They, to me, were the worst kinds of misleaders. And then suddenly Bernie Madoff shows up, this nice little guy who in one part of his life runs a reputable firm and another part of his life manages about 1,500 people and misplaces about $62 billion along the way. I'm afraid that the list would go on much longer than the list of good leaders if we had time.
Well, the examples you just gave point me toward the last of the 10 virtues, at least in the order you present them in the book, deep selflessness. That sounds like it was lacking among Ken Lay and the others at Enron. Talk about selflessness as an important virtue.
I think that that's what we really mean by character, that outstanding leaders are not selfish. That is, they are not concerned about self, but they are not selfish. That their primary role and how they see themselves is in service to others. That once you become a leader, your life has now changed. You are not as St. Augustine said, the first and the last rule of leadership is the well-being of those that they lead. And I think that selflessness does not mean that you don't care about yourself. Any parent knows you have to take care of yourself in order to take care of your children. And children are, in some sense, those people we lead. And let's forget all the particular domestic problems that come up along the way about cars, milk, and what you're eating right now. But rather, you give up a part of your life in having children, or you should, I think. And I think that anyone who runs for office is saying, I'm willing to do this for the greater good. This is a republic in the classic sense, that we elect people to be our servants. I loved what Harry Truman said when he gave up the presidency. I return to what Jefferson announced as a higher calling, a higher title, Mr. Citizen.
But that's a paradox, it seems like, because if somebody wanted to come up with a personality profile of someone who sought power and a leadership role, it seems like self-aggrandizement and self-advancement would be one of their core values.
But that's the norm, that doesn't make it right. In point of fact, that's what we want to suggest. There's nothing wrong with ambition. John Adams said, I am ambitious to be successful in freedom so that my children need not worry about freedom as a gift of life, okay? Ambition is a good thing. I want to be, in fact, that wonderful film Patton. Remember, they're sitting, they're being pinned down. It's George Patton and Bradley. And they're sitting down there, and Bradley says to Patton, Georgie, you do this because you love it. I do it because I'm trained to do it, and somebody's got to. That's who I want to hire, not George Patton for all of his bravado and success and technique and competence. I want Omar Bradley, who did it because it was a task to be done. And I think that we have simply been, if I'm talking too much, make me stop, we've simply been, to accept ambition as narcissism. No, I want to be a good teacher because my students deserve it. I want to be a good surgeon because my patients deserve it. That's ambition that I think is righteous.
And your illustrative example for deep selflessness in your book is Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah, and in retrospect, we should have made it a double characteristic at the end, and that should have been Martin Luther King Jr. and Nelson Mandela in a very real sense. Martin Luther King Jr. was not a man without his own peculiar personal failures. He was a man who liked a Baptist minister who liked to drink and liked to smoke and liked clothes, and by his own admission and by his wife's admission was not totally faithful during the course of his marriage. But putting that aside, at the age of 27 years old, he became the leader of a movement that he had no desire to be in. But once he was there, he realized that it was his responsibility, and he dedicated his life to it. Now, I think we're both old enough to remember that Martin Luther King was not the only leader of the black movement, the civil rights movement at the time, that he was not universally always loved on every issue, but he drove civil rights in a way that it would never be driven before and in a way that it would not be stopped. Having said that, when he was shot on that balcony in Atlanta, it halted the movement, but it did not destroy it. And I think Nelson Mandela, who's still with us at 95 years of age, is my hero of heroes. He is Africa's Lincoln, although both men are clouded by mystery and mystique and, you know, a kind of iconic folklore. He referred to 27 years in prison as the University of Life. He went in a terrorist and a rebel. He came out a Gandhian pacifist and a Democrat. There's something magnificent about that transition, and both men, that I should be lauded.
We're talking to Al Genie about the value of character, of ethics and values in leadership, and we'll touch on some more of the values he's looking for in a great leader. He's co-author of The 10 Virtues of Outstanding Leaders.
We're talking about leadership now with Al Genie, and we want to hear from you. Who would you point to as a great leader in politics, in business, in the spiritual realm? Maybe someone you've worked with. What makes a great leader, and what qualities go into that leadership? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email talk@wpr.org.
Al, we'll get to the phones in a couple minutes, but I wanted to get into some more of the virtues you talk about. Let's go with the first one, deep honesty. How does that work? Why is that an important virtue?
Can I back up and say the 10 we've listed are 10 that we think are kind of critical, but there are others as well. When you understand virtue to be a habit, a chosen behavior that that advances the good life, that lets us live better with others, we think that these 10 are kind of sine qua non, you know, basic. But of course there would be others, but one has to limit one's realm. Well, deep honesty, you know, that's part of almost the selflessness. I think that we have to avoid deception. We have to avoid misinterpretation. What a concept, you know, honesty and advertisement. I think deep honesty is about trust, transparency, and being willing not to deceive in an intentional manner. That doesn't mean you answer every question, but it does mean sometimes you say, as a leader, no comment, I'm not sure, I'll get back to you. That's not a weakness. Rather, that's a clarification and an invitation to ask me again when I know.
And the example you give there, James Burke.
Yeah, the famous Tylenol, and part of that Tylenol happened right here in Chicago. Tylenol happened not far from where I'm speaking right now, where when seven people went down with what was considered now random urban terrorism, cyanide put into Tylenol, and Burke came in there and said, "We're through." You know, everyone said, "You're through. This is done. Close this down. Tylenol is over. Johnson & Johnson is big enough." And he said, "No, we got to find out what's going on here. We have an obligation to our stakeholders, to the people we work with, the people we work for, and the people we come to work to serve. We got to find out what happened here. It's not enough to just avoid liability or pay this off. We want to understand what went wrong." And so even though he could have taken the easy way, he did the right thing for the right reason on purpose. He examined everything at the Tylenol end. He did all reparations possible for the victims at the time. And ironically, at the end, 10 years later, they received about a $50 million settlement because there should have been some preparation for it, but it was a technicality. But I think James Burke wound up being the good guy here because he was trying to be helpful. He wasn't simply trying to CYA, a term from Vietnam, which I'm sure the audience is aware of. He was trying rather to be honest, be open, and tell the truth.
Well, and that would be the gut instinct a lot of the time, cover your rear end and lawyer up.
Right. You know, Mark Twain once said, when in a difficult situation, tell the truth. It'll befuddle your enemies and surprise your friends. But I think there's something absolutely correct about that. And, you know, deep honesty is really about truth. And when I tell my students, when I ask my business students, what's the word fiduciary mean? Well, they say, money responsibility, you know, money obligations. I said, no, not at all. It isn't financial. It starts with an F. It's from fidere, the Latin for truthfulness. That's why dogs used to be called Fido. To be truthful, to be dependable. That's really the bond between business, the bond between lovers, the bond between friends, that you can trust me, that I will be faithful to our relationship. Infidelity in marriage is not about having sex with another, but rather by being unfaithful, emotionally unfaithful in regard to truth with another, which would include sex, but not the only issue.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Scott with us in Iron River. Hi there, Scott.
Yes, hi. My question has to do with political leadership. It seems that politics has always been divisive, but at least in the past, there have been leaders that have worked to get along. And it's very frustrating nowadays to see that politics seems to have disintegrated into, let's see, you know, how bad we can make the other side of the other person look and so forth. And just appreciate your comments on what we need to get things turned around. Thank you very much.
I can't answer the last part, but I think that the caller is absolutely correct. But first of all, let's back up. I think politics is always adversarial. And I think, by the way, within a democracy, that's the point, that you have different points of view, that that adversary doesn't mean hatred, enemy. It means debate and discussion. If you look back in history, Washington and John Adams had horrible times with Congress. So did, you know, Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson. And certainly in the Civil War, there were so many different cliques in Congress. Lincoln was hamstrung left, right, and sideways. But I think what's happened in the modern age, there used to be a time when senators all lived in Washington. There used to be a time when congressmen knew each other and recreated with each other, in which they were the loyal opposition because they had to live there. Now they're always gone. I think what's happened now is kind of niche politics, that it's totally adversarial in this sense. If you've got power, instead of the loyal opposition to help correct and manage, our job is to take over that power. And I think that that was really came to bear with the Clinton administration. They wanted Clinton out. Now, I'm not saying that Mr. Clinton wasn't guilty of a couple of unfortunate incidents. But the point is, it became as if you're not there. When Jimmy Carter won this thing, it was like, why are you there? We want that from you. So I think adversary has now become opponent for power rather than adversary for the people.
Let's talk about one of the political leaders you use as an example in your book, Winston Churchill, in your chapter on moral judgment and moral vision.
And we chose, Churchill can be used, you know, Winston Churchill, fill in the blank. You know, what do you want to say about him? He's one of those characters, right? But we wanted to use him for moral vision because of Churchill's tenacity. Churchill, you know, Churchill, by the time Hitler was coming around in 1933, was a backbencher. You know, he had been guilty of Gallipoli and the war. He had served marvelously in the war. He had been in the cabinet, so on and so forth. But now he's a backbencher, an old guy, drank a lot of alcohol and wrote a lot of books that nobody read. But he was still in Parliament and still paying attention, and he kept saying, this Nazi guy is not just another leader. He's not just the new guy on the block in Germany that's going to help Germany get out of its depression. And you got to remember, 1939, both FDR and Adolf Hitler were 6 years in office and had taken their countries out of the depression, and in 1939, Hitler was Man of the Year for Time magazine. He kept saying, this is evil. This man is evil. I've read Mein Kampf. I've had it translated. I read one of the first translations. I've read the news reports. I've talked to journalists. This is evil. This is a clash of civilizations. Unless we prepare ourselves for this, we'll be doomed and damned. He was right, and he kept saying that. And it's only by his tenacity that, in some sense, Chamberlain was put out of office, and a real defense of England began. And happily, Dunkirk didn't happen on the negative side, and Churchill immediately went to America and said to FDR, this is going to happen to us unless you're involved in this as well. And those two men plotted the salvation of the world.
A couple more examples I wanted to get into. Aesthetic sensitivity as a virtue of a leader. That's a different one.
Yeah, that is totally different. And my colleague Ron Green, who is this wonderful, it was such a pleasure writing with a dear friend, and we're still friends, how about that, and planning other books. We wanted to talk about a sense of sensitivity. You know, everyone talks about intellectual excellence, and certainly, you know, when we talk about politics, you're talking about Jefferson and FDR and even JFK, this hunger, this openness to, you know, new knowledge. But also aesthetic sensitivities. And I think Steve Jobs didn't create the computer. He created a beautiful computer. He created a beautiful way of learning. He changed how we learn, what we learn, what's available to us, even if you know people have planned on that. And I think, as Daniel Pink talks about, we don't just make products. We have to make beautiful products. As someone once said, the gentleman at General Motors said, "We're not in the car business. We're in the business of design, and we just happen to have what we design as things that take us around." I think that beauty is part of our lives, and I think it's a feature of our lives, and I think that that has to be brought into us as well. You know, we have a mayor that is now gone, Mayor Daley in Chicago. Oh, I'm sure he's going to be castigated here, there, and everywhere for a while. You know how that goes. But he made Chicago beautiful, and he'll always be remembered for that. And I think that's a part of leadership.
One more I wanted to get to, the idea of compassion and care as a virtue as exemplified by Oprah Winfrey.
Yeah, another strange one, because here's what we're committed to. And then we'll bring in Oprah, not as a defense, but as an example. I think leaders have to be emotionally connected to their leadership, that is, to those they lead. I think there has to be a human connection. Woodrow Wilson, again, in the book, what I'm finding wonderful about reading this Woodrow Wilson book is he is not this automaton we now see in the old films and, you know, the pictures where he's kind of stiff as a board, this Presbyterian guy from Princeton, you know, professor from Princeton. He ends up being a completely passionate human being who loved his wives, chased his second wife around the White House, if you will, figuratively and literally, a real human being. But one of his problems was, and when he went out on the stump, people knew that. But he had to get out there all the time. You need a leader, and certainly the modern press, the modern media, you know, the most photographed man in the world every single day is, you know, the President of the United States, both by law and by tradition now. You need someone who resonates with others. And in a very real sense, Oprah Winfrey's success is based on her being able to resonate with an audience and creating not simply an audience, but a followership. When her show was on, 44 million people a week watched it. My mother would rather have shot her foot off than miss it, right? And what she created was a pool of people who were not dependent upon her, but looked to her for something. That's still leadership. She changed culture. She changed what we read and how we read. She changed many people's lives in different ways. And I think that was kind of a stretch, but in a very real sense, her success is built on the fact that people really believed that she liked them.
Al, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
This has been a pleasure for me.
That was Al Jeanney. He's a professor at Loyola University Chicago. He's co-author of the new book, 10 Virtues of Outstanding Leaders.